Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. We start with some debt-related news and facts for the week. And from an article in the Des Moines Register by Albert, courts need tool for paring home debt. Corporations can use cram down to whittle their obligations. Why can't homeowners? Is this fair? Corporations can go to bankruptcy court and use a process called cram down to rewrite contracts and reduce what they owe to unions, retirees, and other creditors, but individuals cannot. I raise the question because consumer advocates and others are concerned that banks are moving too slowly to resolve the problems of millions of homeowners whose properties are now worth less than the amounts they owe on their mortgages. Farmers had borrowed too much to buy farmland at inflated prices, and when that bubble burst, the land was not worth the mortgage value. Banks opposed that change 3 decades ago, but they eventually lost. This time, Congress has held firm with bankers who oppose extending cram-down powers to individuals. To understand why, it helps to know a little history. U.S. bankruptcy laws underwent a major overhaul in 1978, but before that, judges had cram-down powers over home mortgage loans, said Iowa State University economist and professor emeritus Neil Harl. The justification for removing that power was that banks needed to be encouraged to provide more home mortgages, Harl said. The idea was that if they prevented cram down, it would encourage mortgage lending, agreed Professor Catherine Porter, who teaches bankruptcy law at the University of Iowa College of Law. But she added, there's very little empirical evidence either way to say if that is true or not. For example, she said, when cram-down protection was given to farmers in the 1980s, there was no real evidence that it caused a reduction in credit to farmers. Debt reduction is an important part of our national heritage, said Joe Pfeiffer, a bankruptcy lawyer in Cedar Rapids. When the United States was started, a lot of people came here to get out of debt, he said. The fact that you can cram down debt and start over again is one of the things that makes our economy work so darn well. You can fail and get on with it and move on with your life. In many emerging countries, there is not the ability to start over. If you lose it once, you are done. So what's the real difference today between people and businesses? Why are bankers and Congress so opposed to giving bankruptcy judges the power to cram down the debts of individuals, while they don't object to widespread cram downs in corporate bankruptcies? The difference, said Porter, reflects a general belief that we have to worry about moral hazard and abuse by individual people, but somehow in the corporate context, there will be enough other big players that there will be a check on that kind of behavior. We think it's okay for businesses to make rational cost-benefit decisions and break promises based on what is possible within the boundaries of the law, she said. But we have this real anxiousness about people making cost-benefit decisions. There's a negative stigma attached to a person who makes a rational choice to walk away from a house that is worth less than they owe and rent an apartment, Porter said. But when businesses do that, we call it great business. We would say it's a smart financial decision. If homeowners do the same thing, it is said they are being abusive, they are taking advantage of the system, they are gaming it, or they are not honoring their promises. The way we think about individual versus corporate debt probably has as much to do with the availability of credit as the economic argument, Porter said. We don't think fair means the same thing in the consumer context as in the business context. We don't hold businesses to the same moral standards that we do consumers. She's probably right. What other reason is there to protect lenders from having to write off the bad debt they created when they made loans to people who could not afford them to buy homes at inflated values? The sad thing, Porter said, is that it's taken 2 years to set up a bureaucracy-laden, government-backed loan modification system that's produced very weak results. Bankruptcy courts already have the expertise to handle the problem, she said. They just need cram down. And that's from an article in the Des Moines Register. And from a post on beforeitsnews.com, 5 Reasons Not to Pay Your Credit Cards by John Galt. Are you one of the millions of Americans trying to decide between paying your credit card bills and eating? We live in a matrix that goes to unspeakable expense to nurture us from the teat to be good consumers. You are issued a tax collection number at birth, Social Security number, another artificial number for your credit worthiness, FICO, and then you are extended a certain amount of tokens to play life based on those numbers. This virtual currency, not unlike your earned Farmville coins, only has value because you give it value. It's a brilliantly designed game. The banksters create a unit of money out of thin air, lend it to people with interest attached, get them to buy real items, then raise the rates, force people to work harder, hover like a vulture until expected default occurs, and rake in the forfeited assets. Best of all, when the whole Ponzi scheme comes crashing down because they drunkenly gambled with your interest payments, the very people who destroyed you get bailed out by you with tax money, and they call you the thieves when you can't pay them back. The game is rigged for the house, and it's always a win-win for them and a lose-lose for you. Sure, you get to rent a flat-screen TV, a car, or a home from them, making life in the Matrix almost worth it. But ultimately, you only temporarily use that stuff at great expense to you and massive profits to the banks. After years and years of paid interest, you still never truly own anything. The TV is now obsolete and worthless. You must still pay increasing property taxes and insurance on your homes and cars, even when you're done paying the bank 3 times their value, all while they bought your years of servitude with nothing real or tangible. For the many who are contemplating dropping out of the corrupt debtor system, the least impact from the mafia will occur by ignoring your unsecured credit cards. Before you take this action, be warned that you may have to return the signing bonus gift you received when you got your contract to play in the big leagues. Here are the top 5 reasons not to pay your credit cards. If you owe $6,000 on a credit card with a 20% interest rate and you only pay the minimum payment each time, it will take you 54 years to pay off that credit card. During those 54 years, you will pay $26,168 in interest rate charges in addition to the $6,000 in principal that you are required to pay. Under the legal fractional reserve banking system, the banks never actually had the fake money for the credit they extended you in the first place. They added you to their stable of debt slaves with the simple accounting keystroke. The cartel of the large private banks are a proven criminal entity at the heart of most global problems, including, but not limited to, wars, genocide, famine, and resource plundering. It's immoral to continue to support such a system on any level. You won't need a good credit score to live outside of the Matrix. It's a place in your mind where it is okay to not ever use anything with bank financing for the rest of your life. And finally, not paying your credit cards may be one of the only ways to make the matrix feel the weight of your protest without drawing too much oppression. Since the foxes guard the chickens on Washington Street, the citizens may have to take justice into their own hands through peaceful resistance by simply dropping out of the matrix. In other words, don't pay your phony debts to criminal banksters. But by not paying your debts, you should expect the system's goons to rain down fear by way of phone calls and mail to you. Additionally, you will certainly risk losing your esteemed Farmville status, and these days you may even win a free trip to one of the oligarchy's private jails. However, you could just wind up gaining some independence from your manufactured stress and servitude. And that's 5 reasons not to pay your credit cards from beforeitsnews.com, John Galt. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So let's now continue with our excursion through the two-income trap, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi. And I start with the credit, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. I also recommend that you go to the archives at www.kruufm.com, look under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows produced in this series to help you to cope with debt, past, present, and future. And in the last several weeks, I've been talking about the house being on fire. In other words, the debt is there and the creditors are looming heavily in your life to try to collect it. Yet there has been something that has caused you not to be able to pay that debt back. I was specifically talking about guilt-free default last week. What about all those bills you will never repay? Whatever you do, don't reassume any old debts. If you filed bankruptcy, we had been talking about bankruptcy actually as an opportunity to deal with your debt. There's a thing called reaffirmation or even post-bankruptcy where a family signs on to pay off debts that they no longer owe after the bankruptcy. Why? It's generally because people don't understand their rights. And part of that is they didn't have a lawyer who explained them. Creditors routinely bully bankrupt families by threatening to repossess the family's possessions, even when they can't do that. Yet, even if it is something that is collateralized, except for the house or car, this, even with collateralized debt, is almost always an empty threat. Creditors almost never repossess because it's just not worth their time and money. It typically costs a creditor at least $350 to send a truck to your house and cart something away, and even more to clean it up and resell it. Are your used goods actually worth that much? There may be some creditors who do it just to make a point, but it's rare that they're going to take their money and throw it away against items that are never going to recoup the original loan, no less the additional costs in trying to collect on it. Another favorite tactic is to warn families that no one will ever issue them another credit card after they file for bankruptcy. Many creditors hire agents to patrol the waiting rooms in the bankruptcy courts in big cities, typically friendly older ladies who make seemingly generous offers. And it sounds absurd, but what they say is the company is willing to extend you a line of credit if you'll agree to repay the balance on your credit card. But think again before you sign. These agents may seem like nice people, but they are peddling poison. Not only will you get stuck paying a bill you no longer owe as a result of the discharge in bankruptcy, but the effective interest rate on that new line of credit may be as high as 1,000% when you add in all of the costs, etc. Sometimes people get these cards, even secured cards, where they put down $500, and when they get their first bill, not having used it at all, they owe almost all that money in startup costs and charges. It's absurd, but people get sucked into this. And then the next issue is, how will you get a new credit card if you forfeit your old one? My first response is don't. As I just alluded in the article I read about five reasons to not pay your credit card debt, you don't really need credit cards, despite what the media and some businesses try to tell you. You can get along quite well without them if you go to a cash basis, or at least use a debit card, which involves your own money on a cash flow basis. Yet, the truth is, even when people file bankruptcy, within 6 months of filing bankruptcy, 84% of families had already received unsolicited offers for new credit. Of course, the interest rate is high, but is it not for almost everyone already? Half of bankrupt families receive more than 30 offers for a new credit card. And in fact, it could be that you feel like you're more popular after filing bankruptcy with the credit card companies than ever before, because lenders know that you cannot declare bankruptcy for another 8 years. Generally, that's a Chapter 7 bankruptcy to a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. You don't have any other debt that you're carrying, and they believe you may still be under enough financial strain that you'll soon end up carrying a balance and making minimum monthly payments, rocketing you to number one on their list of its favorite customers. That's where they make almost all of their money. So as Professor Warren concludes, don't worry. There is life after bankruptcy. You will have a lot more credit at your disposal than you need, and probably a lot more than you should use. So just hang tough, and don't let yourself be bullied or threatened. That's hard. We know it's hard, but you have to stay firm. The creditor is not your friend, and you should not sign away your future before the ink is dry on your bankruptcy petition. And as I discussed in the lead article from the Des Moines Register, we hear the chorus of self-blame and guilt tuning up. These companies lent you money, so aren't you obligated to pay them back? Yes, you are, but only up to a point. You are also obligated to keep a roof over your children's head, to put food in their mouths, and to get them medical care that they need. Children take precedence over creditors, and in fact, so do you and your health and your relationship with your spouse. Besides, most lenders knew you would have a tough time paying them back. They had your credit reports, they knew how much money you earned, and they knew how much you owed. They took a calculated risk. If everyone had stayed healthy and you hadn't lost your job, you would have paid your debts and your creditors would have made a very handsome profit. But that didn't happen. Whenever a bank makes a loan, it hopes to make money, but lenders know that there is some chance that the money will never be repaid. The interest charges and penalty fees are designed to cover those risks, and the banks are doing just fine even when they lose from time to time. Again, going back to the article in the Des Moines Register, think like a business person. Do you imagine that the CEO of United Airlines and the president of Kmart were racked with guilt when their companies filed for bankruptcy? I don't think so. They did what they thought was best for their shareholders and customers, and if that meant that some creditors ended up with the short end of the stick, then so be it. They saw it as simply a matter of good business. When your family's welfare is at stake, so should you. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, we've been talking for a long time about the two-income trap, where both parents are out working, and how the whole economic and budgetary system was metamorphized to include both incomes for necessities. And then, of course, ways to deal with that. But the common response is, should you or your spouse quit your job and stay home so you won't be in any danger of falling into the two-income trap? If you are like the millions and millions of normal American parents, you are already up to your eyeballs in mortgage payments and tuition bills, and pulling out of the workforce will only make things worse. What you need to do is what we discussed a couple of weeks ago, the basic financial fire drill, and then make some calls to your senators and do the best you can under the circumstances. For some families, keeping a parent at home is at least possible. But is it a good idea, financially speaking? It isn't a bad solution if you can afford it. If you would prefer to have a parent at home full time, but were afraid that it would be too risky economically, then don't worry. The idea that it takes two incomes to be financially secure is dangerously wrong-headed from the beginning. The data in Professor Warren's book show that a family with a stay-at-home parent has an important source of economic security, a backup earner and caregiver who can step in if anything goes wrong. So as long as you can get by on a single income and the stay-at-home parent can enter the workforce if the need arises, then go right ahead and quit your job. And what if both parents prefer to work? By all means, just do it. The two earners does not mean an inevitable dive into the two-income trap. It just means that there is more risk and the family must plan accordingly. The financial planning book typically treat one and two income families the same, telling you to add up your family's income, divide by the expenses, and fill in the blanks. But they are not the same. Without a safety net, your two-income family must be careful not to budget as tightly as a one-income household. If at all possible, think of that second income as a safety net, a special reserve for bad times. When times are good, put something in savings and spend the rest of that second paycheck on restaurants, nice clothes, treats, and again, focus on it being a safety net, a special reserve for bad times. If you can avoid committing it to the mortgage and the health insurance or a car payment, you'll get to enjoy the benefits of having two incomes while staying secure. So staying at home can be a possibility. And it does add wonderful advantages to a family life with small children if one of the parents is at home and tending to the children, nurturing the children. There's fewer costs for childcare and for all of the things that are a result of the children being separated from the parent. So it can work, and it does work. And historically, before the two-income economy, it did work. But another solution that is suggested by Professor Warren is actually the two-income couple without children. So the solution of no children. Professor Warren points out that some women have found this to be a way to avoid the two-income trap. It doesn't involve loading up on insurance policies or conducting a financial fire drill, nor does it require you to keep a spouse at home full-time. And unlike the other solutions she presented, it is cost-free and highly effective. Simply don't have kids. Childlessness may not be a calculated economic strategy, but it has powerful economic consequences. By foregoing childbearing, a woman decreases her chance of going bankrupt, for example, by 66%. She reduces the likelihood that she will ever deal with a collection call or worry about a repo man, and she increases the chances that she will hold on to her home. And this improved financial security will last a lifetime. By remaining childless, a woman generally improves her odds of having a comfortable retirement. Now, a few generations ago, advising women not to have children would have seemed ridiculous. Not only would it have defied the social norms of the time, which assumed that everyone would become parents, but the advice would have been viewed as economically self-destructive. At one time, men and women viewed children as economic assets. Youngsters lent a hand on the farm or in the shop. They looked after their younger siblings, and most important, they cared for their aging parents. Little wonder that parents were expected to shoulder the cost of bringing up these children. After all, the parents reaped the rewards. Children are still economic assets. Today's children will build the economy of tomorrow, defend the nation in future wars, care for the sick, construct new buildings, repair the roads, and support the next generation of elderly through, at least, hopefully, Social Security. But there is a key difference now. These benefits will go to society at large, not to specific parents. Moreover, most of the contributions from today's children will not occur until they have grown up and left home. In the modern economy, few children earn their keep by sweeping out the family store or gathering the next harvest, although it does still happen a lot in Iowa. In fact, the summer baseball program for high schools is based on the traditional planting season in the spring. Can't be on the baseball field and out in the farm fields at the same time. But most kids will be a financial burden well into adulthood. And I don't have to tell parents much of the details about that. We all know. In just a few generations, the calculus of raising children has changed dramatically. Most middle-class parents are investing more and more in their own children, while at the same time, society at large claims an ever-growing share of the rewards of those investments. As a column in the U.S. News and World Report observed wryly, at the individual family level, a child, financially speaking, looks more like a high-priced consumer item with no warranty. For economic man in the late 20th century, child-rearing had become a crummy financial bargain. And I don't think this has changed at all in the 21st century. In fact, it may be exacerbated. So that's a fundamental reality. Bringing up children has indeed become a crummy financial bargain. But they're wrong in another regard. Signing on to have children is quite different from buying a high-priced consumer item, with or without warranty, if having children were like buying, say, a Mercedes-Benz with a high preset price tag that could be clearly accounted for, then prospective parents could make the usual set of financial choices posed by the typical economic textbook. They could choose among several options, the Mercedes, the BMW, or Rolls-Royce. Reasonable people could make informed choices depending on their preferences, and they could abandon or resell their purchases if the cost got out of hand. But the cost of a child is not so neatly packaged. It's not possible to calculate the 18-year or 22-year price tag of an individual person with her unique talents, needs, and desires before she is even conceived. Nor does it matter that a prospective parent did not budget for the baby with asthma package or the costly diploma at the private college for the kid who is denied admission to State U. Parents make the commitment to meet their children's needs long before they know the full price. And that commitment will color the parents' financial prospects for the rest of their lives. And we will continue on this analysis next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable day.